is there something wrong in what we learn about connecting the world? At the time of Arab Spring, everyone thought, wow, what a great thing this is, connecting the world there.
It was such an enchanting dream that that connecting us all closer together was going to bring us closer together.
Sex for favors, secrets, cover-ups, corruption.
Such a nasty one.
Pizzagate is real. Do you understand that? I don't like them putting chemicals in the water that turn the friggin' frogs gay. Serious crap.
Det virker som en evighet siden nå. I 2011 sveipet protestbevegelser over hele verden. Det begynte med den arabiske våren i Midtøsten, men også i USA, Europa og noen land i Asia var det store demonstrasjoner. Synet på internett og sosiale medier var et ganske annet da. Opprøret i Egypt ble kalt en Facebook-revolusjon, og de første protestene i Syria ble filmet av vanlige folk med smarttelefoner og spredte seg raskt på nett. Det hersket en idé om at internett og sosiale medier kom til å binde oss sammen og gi vanlige folk muligheten til å bringe sine opplevelser ut i en global offentlighet. Det skulle gi oss mer demokrati. Bare 5 år senere blir Donald Trump valgt til president i USA. En mann som har et mer eller mindre uttalt mål om å plukke fra hverandre demokratiske institusjoner. I løpet av årene som har gått siden, har vi blitt stadig mer bevisst på hvordan desinformasjon og manipulerende innhold på nett bidro til fremveksten av the alt-right og valget av Trump. Bevegelsen mot det autoritære har selvsagt dype røtter ute i verden utenfor skjermene. Men dette er historien om hvordan det rådende synet på internett og sosiale medier gikk fra optimistisk utopi til håpløs dystopi på 5 korte år. Jeg heter Tore Årseth, og du hører på Oh My God, Get The Fuck Out. Hvem ødela internett? I forrige episode hørte vi Shafika Hudson snakke om desinformasjonskampanjen End Father's Day, og hvordan svarte feminister avdekket falske kontoer ved hjelp av hashtaggen Your Slip Is Showing. Denne hendelsen, som hadde sitt utspring i nettforumet 4chan, var en tidlig utgave av desinformasjonskampanjene man har sett i senere tid, blant annet i det amerikanske presidentvalget i 2016, og det inneholdt mange av taktikkene brukt under den virale trakasseringskampanjen Gamergate. Mer hverdagslig trakassering har også kommet til å prege hverdagen for mange på nett. I denne episoden skal vi høre Soraya Kemali snakke om hvordan det er å være en profilert kvinne på nett, og hvordan internettets økonomi er innrettet sånn at trakassering og hat er lønnsomt.
How's that? In about 2011, I realized that as a writer, it didn't really matter what I wrote. I could write about toys, I could write about glass, I could write about rape. It didn't matter. There was just a hostile, vitriolic response online. And when I started talking to other women, almost all of them that had a public voice, certainly public voices that were anti-racist and feminist, were getting these kinds of messages. And so one day I remember sitting with a group of writers and we were making jokes about the rape threats that we were getting. And I thought, you know, we shouldn't be making jokes about rape threats. I know it's a way of dealing with it, but in fact, this is a big problem. It's a big problem that this is part of our work lives and that we're just supposed to accept it and keep working. And the problem was women, there were other women that weren't joking about it, but they were also stopping their work. They weren't writing anymore. They were choosing to censor themselves. They were choosing not to write about certain issues or in certain places. Like, I couldn't understand why it was that both companies and the media didn't see these attacks on women as attacks on some fundamental rights in society.
Det var denne erfaringen som gjorde at Kemali involverte seg i ulike initiativer for å få bukt med problemet. I 2013 var Kemali en av initiativtakerne bak kampanjen Facebook Rape Campaign. På den tida var det vanlig med voldtektsvideoer og humor rundt voldtekt på Facebook. Det kunne være bilder av bevisstløse jenter med en liksom humoristisk tekst om hvordan hun nå skulle voldtas. I løpet av kampanjen ble det sendt rundt 60 000 Twitter-meldinger og 5 000 meldinger til selskapet som hadde reklame på Facebook, hvor reklamene stod ved siden av voldtektsbildene.
It was quite staggering, actually, because they used to have a policy whereby, in order to give themselves legal cover, they would put a parenthetical on any page that was quote-unquote controversial, and in the parentheses they would put humor or satire or controversial humor, and they literally turned the violence into a joke. It was their way of washing their hands and saying it's free speech, people can do what they want. But they just had a different set of standards if the violence and harassment being depicted was of women. It's as though they really couldn't see it as hateful, but they could see it as humor and entertaining. And so a lot of free speech advocates initially criticized us for wanting to censor speech. And my response to that is, well, that's all well and good, but these companies are censoring speech. They're moderating speech. They are 24/7 regulating free speech online. So if that is the case, at the very least, they can do it in a way that doesn't discriminate specifically against women and against women intersectionally. So if you're a Black woman, if you're a Muslim woman, if you're a trans woman, the chances are that you're more likely to be harassed, but because you're a woman, they're just not going to recognize it. The United States as a culture has an outlier free speech ethos. Free speech values often trump other values in our democracy. And I press people to answer the question, why? Why should a person's free speech trump another person's safety, dignity, you know, their whole realm of other constitutional values that are valid? And yet free speech in these debates often take priority. And there are good reasons for that, because in fact, to have a thriving democracy, you need to have free speech. Check, got it, yes. But arguably also, to have a thriving democracy, you have to have at a bare minimum physical autonomy, safety, and the ability to live with dignity. You could say that too, right? So if you look at the companies that now regulate speech at scale globally, these are privately held companies. They are making decisions all day, every day about who can speak, in what context, in what way, using what language to say yes or no to any number of issues, right? And so in my mind, who gave them this authority? Why is it that they get to say that a racist, misogynist's free speech trumps another person's right to be in a space and speak without this level of harassment? And to me, that's a different question than the government shutting you down. And I think it's an important question, because now these corporations function as proto-governments transnationally. They're regulating speech all over the world with no oversight, with very little transparency, with almost no accountability, and in a market environment in which they profit from harassment. Because harassment generates engagement, and engagement is the currency of their business model.
Hvorfor det så lett å reagere spontant på overdrivelser og falske nyheter på nett? Psykologen Molly Crockett har forsket på moralsk harme og hvordan denne menneskelige mekanismen fungerer på internett. Opprinnelig var moralsk harme en sosial funksjon som utviklet seg i små grupper for å gi retningslinjer for moralsk oppførsel innad i gruppa. Det var en måte å få gruppa til å fungere godt sammen ved å sanksjonere antisosial oppførsel. Men på nett? I 2014 viste en studie fra Universitetet i Illinois at innhold på nett som omtalte umoralske handlinger skapte sterkere følelser enn når man selv så umoralske handlinger ute i verden eller formidlet gjennom tradisjonelle nyheter på TV eller i aviser. Crockett mener at måten nettet fungerer på blåser den moralske harmen ut av proporsjoner. Hun sammenligner det med sukker eller junkfood, noe usunt som man blir avhengig av. Noe av mekanismen bak at annonseøkonomien på nett knyttet til delinger, og at det som blir delt mest det som skaper de sterkeste følelsene. Dermed får man en overflod av innhold som vekker moralsk harme, men kanskje ikke har så stor verdi for samfunnet. I tillegg det en lavere terskel for å uttrykke sinne på nett. Å gjøre det ansikt til ansikt kan være ubehagelig eller til og med farlig, mens på nett så det enkelt. En interessant observasjon at deltakerne i den virale trakasseringskampanjen Gamergate selv mente at de gjorde det rette. De mente helt alvorlig, og mange mener fortsatt at Gamergate handler om etikk i spilljournalistikken, og at den kvinnelige spillutvikleren som fikk all trakasseringen rettet mot seg, fortjente det.
Right now, hate and harassment are super profitable. There is no economic motivation right now to cut hate and harassment off at its knees. Because in fact, it generates so much traffic, so much engagement that it just kind of makes sense. Either way, they make money. And that incentive structure is dangerous for society. I haven't personally seen a good alternative model, but right now there's really no responsibility at all. There's no real price to be paid for proliferating misinformation, for example. There's nothing. I really don't know what the price is. And so how can that be? How can it be that we sustain this environment in which misinformation is profitable? That would seem to be a centrally important question in a regulatory way. Like what I'm saying to you and what we're trying to do at the Women's Media Center, it's still a huge fight. It's a constant fight. Because in fact, these levels of harassment shut down the free speech of already marginalized voices. They make it much harder. They are actively suppressing free speech. But it's hard to capture a negative, right? It's hard to say, look at the damage that you've done, because there is virtually no way to measure that damage. Although some surveys really do show that women in particular are much more likely to stop engaging, to get off of a platform. And that's because the harassment is more emotionally resonant for women. These surveys also show that women have a stronger response to the harassment. And that makes sense too, because generally speaking, there's a safety gap. Women are also less likely to be walking alone at night, right? Because it's more dangerous for them to walk alone at night in American cities. And so they're hypervigilant to the fact of violence. And they're also usually being attacked by people they know, not by strangers. So it makes sense. It's a rational choice for them to be more responsive to the threat.
One thing is sort of the safety issues and the mental toll that it takes to be harassed, but it also takes a lot of time, doesn't it?
It takes time and money.
Yeah.
It takes time and money. I mean, a lot of the activists that I know, you know, they have to spend money to lock down their security. To some of them have to hire consultants to help them, you know, secure their digital identities, and they hire reputation scrubbers, you know, to make sure that they're on top of impersonations or malicious actors. And they also, a lot of them end up hiring therapists, because actually to be attacked regularly in that way just takes a toll. And so there are real financial impacts to doing this. It also makes it harder to do your work. And it does take time. It takes a lot of time to manage all of these things. I think part of what's happened is that as the result of Trump's election in the United States, there has been more of this kind of speech, and mainstream media has paid more attention to it as a result. I think that getting mainstream media to really focus on it before was very hard sometimes, because it didn't seem like a major problem to them. They didn't connect the dots between, for example, the pervasive online harassment of Black women activists and larger movements of white supremacy or white nationalism or macho fascism.
And how do you think those dots connect?
So I think that if you've been online for any length of time and you've been thinking about these issues, you can see the way in which globally misogyny becomes the bridge between various types of hate groups. Contempt for women is like a lingua franca. So if you're looking at incel groups, white supremacist groups, white Christian nationalist groups, male supremacist groups, pickup artists, men's rights activists, it's like a huge Venn diagram of disaffected, entitled masculinity. And those groups may be different, but what connects them is a defense against women's equality. So, you know, if you think about what was happening with your slip is showing, which was targeted harassment, impersonation, misinformation, deliberately creating a campaign to divide and to cause anger and friction. And you see that as a small model of how to do things, like a practice ground. And then you see it explode in a movement like Gamergate. And then Breitbart, a conservative news outlet, which had nothing much to do with gaming, latched on to Gamergate and to the community that was driving the hateful aspects of Gamergate and converted that community quite successfully into a political force in the U.S. election. And so then you end up with the ridiculousness of something like Pizzagate.
One of the big surprises of the presidential campaign was the explosion of fake news on the internet, fantastic tales that some believe to be true.
28-year-old Edgar Welch was arrested in Washington Sunday afternoon outside Comet Ping Pong, a popular family pizza parlor. D.C. police say Welch fired at least one round into the restaurant floor with an AR-15 rifle like this one on his Facebook page. No one was injured. Police say Welch drove all the way from North Carolina to self-investigate Pizzagate, a fictitious online conspiracy theory.
Pizzagate var en konspirasjonsteori som gikk viralt i oppløpet til det amerikanske valget. Utgangspunktet var e-postene til John Podesta, Hillary Clintons valgkampsjef, som ble lekket av WikiLeaks. Konspirasjonsteoretikerne mente at e-postene inneholdt kodet språk som avdekket Clinton-kampanjen og andre politikere fra det demokratiske partiet drev et omfattende nettverk hvor flere serveringssteder ble brukt som base for seksuelt misbruk av barn. Den notoriske konspirasjonsteoretikeren Alex Jones fra Infowars var blant de som støttet teorien.
Pizzagate is real.
Heldigvis ble ingen skadet i opptrinnet.
Court documents say Welch read online that the Comet restaurant was harboring child sex slaves and he was armed to help rescue them. He surrendered peacefully when he found no evidence that underage children were being harbored in the restaurant.
Og hvis du nå lurer på hva Your Slip is Showing og Gamergate er, så kan du gå tilbake og høre på episode 2 i denne serien.
Right, and I would say there's a pretty straight line development from Your Slip is Showing to Pizzagate. You can watch the community get identified and then flipped and then massaged and then grown and then shifted into that political arena. And at every stage along the way, if you had gone to a mainstream outlet and said, hey, this is happening online right now. We're not paying enough attention to the violence in incel groups, right? Because in the middle of that was Elliot Rodger.
I mai 2014 drepte 22 år gamle Elliot Rodger 6 mennesker i Isla Vista i California før han tok livet av seg selv. Like før lastet han opp en video på YouTube der han forklarte motivasjonen sin. Han ville ta hevn fordi ingen kvinner ville ligge med han, og han misunte menn som var seksuelt aktive. Han identifiserte seg som incel, kort for involuntary celibate, altså en person som ikke klarer å skaffe seg sex, og deltok i kvinnefientlige fora på nett. Nylig har vi sett denne kulturen manifestere seg i Norge også, da Philip Manshaus gikk til angrep på i Nordmoskeen i Bærum etter å ha drept sin adoptivsøster. Også Manshaus skal ha vært tilknyttet incel-miljøet på nett.
And Elliot Rodger was like a big flag to any of us because it was the moment at which everything that was happening online crystallized into this gruesome violence. And gruesome violence that was directly linked to these movements and to these messages and to these words. But if you'd said any of that, you were treated like a crazy person, like a conspiracy theorist, like a feminist who was exaggerating and really didn't understand politics. And I believe there's actually still a lot of that. You know, I don't think necessarily that there's a commanding understanding of how these cultures operate and how implicated they are in the recruitment and radicalization of young white men.
But it's not just individual.
No, of course it's not. The lone wolf. Yes, and actually you described something earlier, which is the incitement without the specific. And that's the term that I think of as stochastic terrorism, which is you don't deliberately say, go and kill these people, but you curry you plant the seeds and you use the language and you create a welcoming environment and you launder the most hateful language to make it socially acceptable. And then you wash your hands of the violence and point to the lone wolf actor.
Enten det alternative medier eller Facebook-grupper som fører an I en konsentrert trakasseringskampanje, eller det den mer dagligdagse trakasseringen som har blitt en del av nettkulturen, så har trakassering på nett blitt et stort problem. En studie fra Pew Research Center viser at 41% av alle amerikanere de spurte I 2017 hadde vært utsatt for trakassering på nett, opp fra 35% bare 3 år tidligere. Interessant nok var det en høyere prosentandel menn enn kvinner som sa at de ble trakassert. Kemali mener likevel at det forskjell på trakasseringen.
And you know, very often, like as a journalist, when I talk about the harassment that women encounter, harassment is a really anodyne word. It's not a very useful word. And very often I'll be in a place where a man will say, well, I get harassed too. And I'll say, okay, well, what does that look like? And he'll say, you know, I get nasty letters and people are always calling me stupid. And I'm like, okay, but do you get like graphic images of cannibalistic porn when you open your inbox in the morning? Because I think that's kind of different, you know? And very often the man will be really kind of surprised. And he's like, what do you mean? And I'm like, you know, people send women porn, not because it's sexually titillating, because it depicts the violent domination of women, and often in ways that are related to their mouths. So if you look at a lot of threats online to women, it's not conscious, but they very often center on this idea of shutting the women up. So oral rape and fellatio, hanging, cutting out your tongue, strangling someone, all of that imagery has to do with closing off the throat. And it's sexualized violence that is focused on that idea. And I just don't think most men who are being harassed as journalists are subjected to that type of imagery. And they're much less likely to be turned into that imagery. I mean, a lot of women who are targeted in these ways, if they're particularly high status, high profile politicians or journalists or celebrities, their images are used that way. They're sexually objectified in that way. And so understanding that sexual objectification as a silencing dehumanization is also very important.
For Kemali handler ikke dette bare om de som blir utsatt. Det handler om kvaliteten på demokratiet vårt.
You need people to participate in public debate, to have robust exchanges of ideas, and to address the issues that are important to a society. And so what happens when certain people in the community are systemically inhibited from participating, systemically discouraged and threatened for sharing their thoughts, their concerns, their opinions, their experiences, their needs. And I think that's where we are, because it's very clear that some people are more at risk when they speak. And so how do we equalize that playing field? How do we create social environments in which marginalized voices are not further marginalized? And what's interesting is, I think a lot of white men feel that they are being silenced and censored. And in a lot of instances, that comes down to their feeling uncomfortable saying what they believe, which is different from being silenced and censored. If you are being threatened with rape, that is qualitatively different from feeling like you are not free to say that 12-year-olds should not be allowed to have abortions. If you say 12-year-olds should not be allowed to have abortions and people get angry at you, you're uncomfortable. But you are not, in fact, being attacked. You aren't being harassed off of a platform, right? You're criticized. You have to live with the criticism. That's qualitatively different from giving your opinion and then having someone say, I'm going to rape you and kill you and your family.
We talked a bit earlier about how especially women of color online had seen this coming for many years, and
yeah,
mainstream media wasn't paying attention. So there's another election coming in a little over a year, and
yeah,
I was wondering, like, what is happening online right now that we're not paying attention to and that we should?
So I am kind of dismayed and appalled. It's as though mainstream media just didn't learn any lessons last time. I don't understand it. I don't understand how they can be reproducing some of the same blindnesses that we know led us to this point. You would think that after the failure of the media to understand Trump's ascent as a global phenomenon, right? Because the other thing too is very often in the United States, and in media, there is this sense of American entitlement and specialness and isolation. Like, what's happening in the United States has nothing to do with what's happening in the rest of the world. And you would believe after the last election that people would be disabused of that, that they would understand what the rise of proto-fascist and authoritarian leaders means globally and how Trump is part of that. And yet, that's not happening. It's almost as though there remains a doubt that what's happening online matters fundamentally, and that the kinds of misinformation that we know did so much damage last time could do the same damage, right? That the systems could be as manipulated. There's also an excessive trust in a kind of technology utopianism, right? That somehow algorithms are going to solve this problem, or that Facebook is going to solve this problem, when they have demonstrated over and over again that they cannot solve this problem, that they cannot assess risk, that they fail to recognize threats. And there are lots of reasons for that that we could get into, but I don't think that's changed much. I think that people acting with malice will find a way to manipulate these systems. Because in fact, these systems were built by people who have an excessive trust in technology and whose own personal life experiences, which is how fast decisions are made, by the way, right? We know that certain decision-making relies on experiential thinking. They don't have the experience of being in the direct line of harm. So they cannot see some of the risks that maybe more inclusive, diverse groups of people building products could see. And so the Women's Media Center, for example, does an annual report on the state of newsrooms and editorial spaces and management of media companies. And there's just a persistent over 20 years, over 25 years, wall. It's as though we cannot get past a certain percentage. And so it's still the truth that between 65 and 90% of people in senior editorial management positions and people responsible for editing, assigning, and writing stories in politics are men. When you look at people of color, women of color, the numbers get even smaller, really small. And so I've never understood why this lack of inclusivity isn't understood as a failure of journalistic ethics, because we know why it's important that communities be represented by people from those communities. And we also know what gets missed when they're not. And so Trump is a spectacular example of what gets missed, right? There were people who understood exactly what Trump represented, particularly Black women who voted against Trump, 98% of Black women. But those women were not shaping our public knowledge. They were not in charge of newsrooms. They were not writing the stories. They were not fighting back when people said, oh, it's not that bad. He'll never win. He's just saying things. And you just can't have newsrooms full of people who are drinking the Kool-Aid. And you do. This is where we are.
En av de mest sentrale mytene Kemali og flere andre intervjuer til denne serien vil til livs, tanken om at det et skille mellom det som skjer på nett og det som skjer i gåseøyene i den virkelige verden. Verden på nett virkelig, og den påvirker det som skjer utenfor nett på tvers av geografi. Likevel, mange av reglene vi var enige om, og rettigheter som var kjempet frem før internett, har ikke blitt med inn i måten de store plattformene ble bygget, og blir heller ikke håndhevet. Et mye omtalt eksempel at de store plattformene sensurerer nakne kvinnebryst, mens menn i bar overkropp ok. Dette konservative sosiale normer som har blitt med inn i hvordan innholdet på nett forvaltes, men det ikke fundert i noen lov. Tilsvarende vil man kanskje ikke akseptere det samme nivået av trakassering ansikt til ansikt som man gjør på nett. Det på tide å innse at de store plattformene en så integrert og viktig del av den delte offentligheten, at de må underlegges regler som demokratisk bestemt, heller enn plattformenes egen politikk?
So if you think about political advertising and who can buy it, newspapers can't run political advertising from foreign governments, for example. But online, Facebook, there was not a rule for Facebook, you know? And so that's a difference. Now we understand why it's important to have a rule. We haven't talked at all about algorithms and algorithmic bias and how they contribute to discrimination and often harassment too. Well, in the 60s, newspapers used to list jobs for men and jobs for women. Mm. That's how jobs were listed. And the agency in charge of all of that stuff in the US, the EEOC, said that's discrimination. You can't do that. So by the mid 70s, it was no longer allowable for newspapers to segregate by sex job listings. So fast forward to now, and essentially what's happening under our noses, invisibly, is that labor markets are being re-sex segregated by algorithmic bias. And nobody has said anything, and there are no laws. But it's happening, right? They can do that legally, right? They can say, I only want this ad to go to women, or I only want this ad to go to men. But actually, it's a little more complicated than that. The language you use to run an ad, so words are coded masculine and feminine. And so if they're coded in that way, more men click on one, and then more men will see it. Mm. So traditional habits in the workplace then become not just descriptive, but predictive of where the ads should go. We know that men are much more likely to be senior executives. So one study showed that men were six times as likely to see ads to be senior executives making $300,000 or more. And so the ways in which traditional sex segregation and discrimination shaped labor markets are now being pumped into the invisible world of algorithms and job search. These processes, these invisible processes, these algorithms are actually doing something that 50 years ago we said was discrimination. And so I'm like, okay, but what are we going to do about this? Because this is a global labor market shaping technology. And crickets. I don't know. I called the EEOC and I was like, hey, I'm just wondering, can you talk to me about what may be happening? And at that point, it was probably 3 or 4 years ago, the woman on the phone said to me, well, if someone brought a complaint, we could investigate. And I'm like, oh my God.
Needed a woman who didn't get the ad for a...
You don't even know. You don't even know, right? And I said, you know, part of the problem is I don't know what I'm not seeing. Mm. How am I supposed to know what I'm not seeing?
Så länge det inte tas höjde för dessa mekanismerna I utformning av algoritmerna och reglerna som styr de stora plattformarna, risikerar vi att miste både tillkämpade rättigheter och demokratiska körregler vi var eniga om för. Jeg spør hva Kamali mener bør gjøres.
So at this point, I literally think on a 25-year horizon. And I think in that framework, as societies, we need to think about how we're educating people in civics and citizenship and digital civics and citizenship. Because this sort of late stage capitalist market freedom that these tech companies are thriving in turn all of us first and foremost into consumers. And it's as though our identities as individuals and citizens are being washed away in this focus on us as consumers. Even the US regulatory framework, which is different from the framework in the EU, is focused on us as consumers. I mean, digital privacy is really important, right? But the way it's framed is usually as a consumer, your privacy is important. Not as a citizen, you have the right, right? That's a totally different conversation. And so I think we need to be educating a generation in what it means to be online, but be a citizen online.
Jeg heter Tore Årseth, og du hører på Oh My God, Get the Fuck Out, Hvem ødela internett? Produsert for Radiotaket, med støtte fra Medietilsynet. I introduksjonen hørte du nyhetsklipp fra CNN med Donald Trump og Hillary Clinton, Alex Jones fra Infowars, et klipp fra Gamergaters on Steam som har brukt stemmen til Jesse Ventura, og opptak fra Pan America's International Voices Festival. I segmentet om Pizzagate hørte du klipp fra CBS Evening News. Musikken Corey Webb med Capsizing fra Tribe of Noise.